Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in this segment, we're going to continue with our analysis of the book Legacy of Deception, subtitled An Investigation of Mark Furman and Racism in the LAPD. That book was authored by Stephen Singular, S-I-N-G-U-L-A-R, published in softcover by Dove Books, copyright 1995. In fact, this book is much more than an investigation of Mark Furman and racism in the LAPD. This book is an analysis, albeit an incomplete one, of the O.J. Simpson case, and in fact, the book presents solid evidence, though by no means altogether conclusive or airtight, that O.J. Simpson was framed. Again, I think the balance of the information presented by Stephen Singular makes an excellent case that O.J. Simpson was framed, but there is obviously much more investigating to be done. I don't think that investigating is likely to be done, certainly not by official sources, and indeed I don't think it is important, past a point, to prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that any given individual, be it Mark Furman or Detective Van Atter or whoever, was involved in framing O.J. Simpson. Beyond that, I don't think it is important to identify the precise nature of exactly who did the killings. Indeed, I think, as we will see in our concluding segment, that what is important here is to understand the failings of society. I think that if any given individual were to pursue the case past a point, it would probably result simply in more bloodshed, and I don't think that's going to accomplish anything at this time. Indeed, I think that the society as a whole has a vested interest in maintaining the popular fiction that O.J. Simpson did it, but got off because of his clever attorneys. As we'll see, his attorneys weren't so clever. They could have proved O.J. was innocent. However, as Stephen Singular's source notes, this case was not about justice. It's about winning. Beyond that, I would indicate that this case was not about truth. It was about winning. Stephen Singular is the author of the book Talk to Death, The Life and Murder of Alan Berg, about the murder of Denver talk show host Alan Berg by Nazi elements known as the Order. Indeed, Stephen Singular was contacted by his source, obviously highly placed within the L.A. legal system, precisely because of his work on the murder of Alan Berg. Indeed, Stephen Singular's source indicated to him that similar elements were behind the framing of O.J. Simpson. These elements, however, within the L.A. legal system. In this segment, we're going to deal with speculative information presented by Stephen Singular. It may turn out to be true, but the formal proof is lacking here, about the true nature of the killings. According to Stephen Singular's source within the L.A. legal system, the actual target of the killings may have been Ron Goldman and not Nicole Simpson. Singular writes about this as follows. And again, this is in a conversation with Bill Pavlik, an LAPD, a former LAPD policeman who was working as an investigator for the defense. Quote, "Perhaps the target of the crime was not Nicole Simpson," unquote. "You mean Goldman?" Pavlik said. "We've considered that possibility all along." "From what I understand," I said, "the police may have known more about this crime than you think they know. They just haven't been able to investigate any other leads." "Why not?" Douglas said. Douglas, of course, Carl Douglas, one of O.J.'s defense attorneys. "Because they're committed to prosecuting and convicting O.J. Simpson and then telling the world that the case is closed. And because the evidence that they've gathered makes it look as if O.J. is guilty. No cop on the street is in a position to challenge the conclusion that the district attorney's office had already reached," unquote. "That's correct," Douglas said. "If someone was after Goldman," Pavlik pressed, "why did the murders take place at Nicole's condo? Why not somewhere else?" I shook my head. Obviously, Singular, interrupting here, does not know. "How many killers were there?" Douglas asked. I said nothing. "You don't know," the lawyer said, "or you don't want to tell us." "There was more than one." "How many?" "Four." Again, Singular was given the number four by his source within the L.A. legal system. "What can you tell us about them?" "I've told you what I've heard. I've gotten you more information and passed it along. I'll keep doing that if you'll keep talking to me." And again, Singular's source indicated that he had heard that there had been four killers and that indeed, according to Singular's source, Ron Goldman, not Nicole Simpson, was the actual target of the killings. I do not know if that is true or not. However, one piece of information that does raise some interesting questions in that regard, and that concerns a burglary that took place at Ron Goldman's psychiatrist's office. Singular writes about this, saying, Around the same time, another event took place in Los Angeles that gained instant national media attention, but was then quickly forgotten. The office of the psychiatrist Ron Goldman had been seeing before his death was broken into and burglarized, and Goldman's file was carted off. I remembered what my source had told me, and what I'd later told Carl Douglas and Bill Pavlik about looking into Goldman's background. Again, the burglary of Ron Goldman's file from Ron Goldman's psychiatrist's office raises some interesting questions, and I have raised the question about whether perhaps the O.J. Simpson case, as I believe, was a domestic intelligence operation. This is one of the curious pieces of information that at least suggests that possibility. Still more about a possible lead on the cases. A singular source within the L.A. legal system indicated that Aspen, Colorado, might hold a key to this particular case, and indeed that people in Aspen might have some concrete information to provide about the case. Singular writes about this, saying, "Months earlier, I'd been told by my source that there was a connection in the case between the two victims, the town of Aspen, Colorado, and another person whose name I did not know. If I could locate this mystery person, it explained to me, I would have found a significant piece of this double homicide puzzle." And as we will see, the trail grows very cold indeed in Aspen, Colorado. Singular contacted a source in Aspen who was in the know, but as this source attempted to unearth more information about the possible identity of the real killers, it became obvious that people were afraid of talking, indicating perhaps that they were afraid of retribution on behalf of the real killers. And indeed, that's one of the reasons why I think it would be ill-advised for private investigators to pursue this particular lead. I think it is simply likely to result in more pointless bloodshed. However, I do think it's important, in order to understand the O.J. Simpson case as an historical and political event, to realize that, in fact, there were some leads leading in the direction of Aspen, Colorado, and that these were not properly pursued. Returning to Legacy of Deception, we read, "In the past, my source had told me there was an important connection in the case between some of the principals and the ski resort of Aspen, Colorado. Because I lived in Denver, he suggested that I look into this. I made a number of calls to Aspen and enlisted the help of a female friend who knew far more about the town than I did. I phoned the local newspaper, the Aspen Times, and was given a couple of leads, but when I contacted these people, they all said they could answer some of my questions if they wanted to, but they did not. Why not? I asked them. I won't go into that. Why not? I just won't. In some ways, Aspen reminds me of Las Vegas. Its mystique and much of its financial success is built on the notion that sex, drugs, and rock and roll are welcome here after dark, but no one wants to talk about that, at least not with a journalist. No one can blame them for that. Every time I spoke to someone in Aspen about the Simpson case, it was clear that they didn't trust me or my motives, but it seemed to me that they held more than a normal level of mistrust for reporters. In the back of their voices was the hint that this was not a subject that they were going to touch. I hadn't expected to get very far with my inquiry, so all this silence wasn't surprising. My female friend, however, had some long-standing acquaintances in Aspen who were known for their ability to gather and dispense juicy gossip. These people wouldn't speak to her either." And again, I don't know what conclusion one can draw from this, but in the live interview that I conducted with Stephen Singular on April 21st of 1996, a three-part interview that will be heard at the end of this series, Stephen Singular indicates that, these people who didn't talk were afraid of retribution on behalf of the interests that launched the killings. And indeed, that's not surprising. That is to say, their reluctance to talk is not at all surprising. Still more about some of the leads running in the direction of Aspen. Singular writes, "There was another person, my source had told me, who tried to come forward and talk to the authorities. This individual had been following the case closely and believed there may have been an explanation for these murders that had never been properly investigated. This person had first-hand knowledge of certain things, according to what I'd been told, and felt that someone should investigate them. One of those things was the belief that Nicole Simpson might not have been the target of the crime. In the late summer of 1994, when I was communicating with the defense team, I passed some of this information along to Carl Douglas. He'd paid attention to what I was saying, but I really didn't expect him to pursue it. He and his colleagues were involved in attacking the specific evidence that the prosecution had collected against O.J. Simpson, and anything that did not directly help them to do that was basically irrelevant. What I was telling Douglas was so far removed from the standard view of these crimes as to be almost fanciful. If the defense team wasn't interested in this information, the prosecution had a long-standing habit of disregarding anything that did not point to Simpson's guilt. Given all that, I did nothing with these tidbits for months and months. Then I decided to try something that was most likely impossible to accomplish and perhaps even foolish to attempt. I had very little to work with because my source did not like dealing in names. In this instance, he said he did not possess the name of the person who tried to come forward, but that it might be found by looking up some past addresses and phone numbers. A series of connections, he told me, fanned out from both of the victims, and if one were to trace those connections closely, one could learn things that had not yet been uncovered. And indeed, that is where the trail ends. Indeed, as I've indicated, I think that it would be unwise for a private individual or individuals to pursue this. It would appear that whoever actually performed the killings is quite powerful, certainly at large, and they will not take kindly to someone informing on them. From an historical and political standpoint, I am not sure how important it is to identify the actual identities of the killers themselves, assuming there was more than one, as Singular Source believes. I think it is important politically, however, to understand that Simpson was not the killer, that others were, and that this society, the prosecution, the defense, the media, the DA's office, and Mr. and Mrs. America and all the ships at sea, so to speak, failed to recognize the reality concerning the O.J. Simpson case. Another point Singular brings out here concerns some of the apparent contradictions in the case. Indeed, one of the things that I wondered about was if, in fact, O.J. Simpson was the killer, as the prosecution alleged, how he could have killed two people with an edged weapon in such a short period of time. And indeed, he obviously could not have killed them both at the same time. One killing would have had to have occurred first. And I wondered why the first victim or the second victim did not see the first. It appeared in the media coverage of the case as if Nicole's condominium had a huge yard, but in fact this was not the case. When Singular went to the crime scene, he found the following information. Most crime scenes are much smaller than you expect them to be. The path leading from the front of the condo to the sidewalk, which had been blood-drenched on June 13th and shown on television thousands upon thousands of times, was in actuality just a few feet long and a few feet wide. The media had made it seem huge. Nicole's home itself also looked shrunken compared to what had been in my imagination. So indeed, I think this suggests that O.J. Simpson could not have been the killer, because he certainly could not have killed both people at exactly the same time. One would have to have been killed first, and I think the question suggests itself rather obviously as to why victim number two, whether it was Nicole or whether it was Ron, would not have seen the body and the blood and the evidence of struggle from victim number one. One of the things that also struck me as odd was that nobody heard anything. There was discussion about a dog wailing, and this was used by the prosecution to try to pinpoint the time of the killings. I wondered why people would not have heard anybody screaming, and indeed, there is speculation concerning the possibility of a martial arts capability on the part of the real killers, and that perhaps a martial arts technique was used to silence the people before their killing. Indeed, there is speculation presented in Singular's book that the killers may have threatened Ron Goldman before actually disposing of him. Singular writes, "Much of what the examiner said about how the crimes had unfolded fit rather neatly into the theory that O.J. Simpson had slashed these two people to death in a jealous rage, wielding the murder weapon like a madman. But a couple of wounds on Ron Goldman didn't fit into that scenario at all. According to the medical examiner, there were two neat, superficial cuts, parallel lines on Goldman's neck. When asked to explain these, the doctor said they were, quote, threatening, unquote, injuries, cuts that had been made when Goldman was being held from behind and someone had placed a knife blade against his skin. The implication was that these were anything but random slash marks. They were small, calculated slices done by a person who was not yet ready to kill, but who was delivering a clear message about what might happen next, perhaps if certain conditions were not met. From the testimony of the medical examiner, one could only conclude that Goldman had done nothing to meet those conditions. One basic question had been hovering around these murders ever since Nicole and Ron had been found dead. How could a single individual, even a large, strong man, have killed two people with a knife without either of these victims making any noise. There were countless theories about this, most of them focusing on the probability that Simpson had killed Nicole first and that Ron had arrived shortly thereafter at the condo and been slain in turn. Some people preferred to reverse the order of the killings, with Nicole happening upon O.J. after he just killed Ron. The prosecution's theory was that Simpson had knocked out Nicole, killed Ron, gone back to Nicole, grabbed her by the hair, raised her head from the ground, and slashed her throat. All of these scenarios were somewhat plausible, but they did nothing to explain away the parallel lines on Goldman's neck. They also did nothing to answer the question of when Goldman had been held from behind, and for how long, and why his attacker had wanted to deliver a threat before cutting his throat. They didn't address what the threat may have involved, and they didn't address why Goldman had not made any sounds during the heated fight that everyone agreed the young man had put up before he died. Martial arts experts will tell you about a particular technique, a headlock choke, that can be used when an attacker is holding a person from behind and wants to keep him or her quiet. By placing the crook of your elbow against the person's Adam's apple and then applying pressure, air will gradually be forced out of the wind passage. This maneuver does not crush the larynx or render the victim helpless, at least for a while, but it leaves him unable to make any sound other than a moan. Was it possible that this technique had been used on Goldman and on Nicole at exactly the same time, when more than one killer was present, so that both of them were rendered mute? Indeed, I think that is an interesting question. The speculative leads presented here and the speculative information presented by Stephen Singular are important. And again, I think the importance is historical, not investigative. I think, again, a person choosing to investigate these leads running in the direction of Aspen might very well meet with foul play themselves at the hands of whoever actually did the killings. It is important, rather, I think, to understand that O.J. was not the killer and that the society as a whole failed, and all aspects of it failed, in not addressing the reality of this particular crime. Indeed, a Singular source said, this case was not about justice, it was about winning. And as I would add to that, this case was not about truth either, but it was about winning, with the exception of Stephen Singular and a handful of other hardy souls who have indeed pursued the truth. In the next segment of Legacy of Deception that I'm going to read, Stephen Singular sums up the information that he was given by his anonymous source within the Los Angeles legal system. And again, although I think there is much more work to be done, and although some of the pieces of information clearly need to be investigated to a much greater extent than they have been, I think that Stephen Singular makes an excellent case that O.J. Simpson was framed, and the information he was given and the treatment accorded that by the various parties in this case is summed up by Stephen Singular as follows. I'd been told about a stick that had been found at Simpson's estate. Although Carl Douglas and Bill Pavlik had initially said this sliver of wood did not exist, it turned out to be real. Despite its appearance at the trial, and despite the fact that both the prosecution and the defense had mentioned it, no one had connected it to anything else in the case. No one had given any explanation for why Detective Furman had originally brought it up at the preliminary hearing. 13 months after I had first spoken to Douglas, the stick remained as mysterious as ever. I'd been told about a blue plastic bag, also recovered from Simpson's residence. Pavlik and Douglas had again said this object was not real, but in fact it was. The bag was mentioned several times in the courtroom, only to be labeled a, quote, fantasy, unquote, by the prosecution. And when given the opportunity to conduct a demonstration using the kind of small evidence bag found in homicide kits, the defense had chosen to use a Ziploc bag. 8 months of testimony had revealed nothing about why the police had found a blue bag just a few feet away from where Furman had told the other detectives he'd spotted the glove at Simpson's home. I'd been told that Furman had known Nicole Brown Simpson, and that roughly half the officers in Furman's police division knew about his connection to her. The internal affairs investigation into this claim provided evidence that it was true. I'd been told about a blood preservative, EDTA, that could be detected in the crime scene blood drops holding O.J. Simpson's DNA. A man with more than 40 years of experience with EDTA, Dr. Frederick Reeders, had come into the courtroom and said that this anticoagulant was present in some of the blood that had been identified as belonging to the defendant. Even the prosecution's rebuttal witness to this testimony, FBI agent Roger Martz, had said under oath that he'd found something in the blood that may have been consistent with EDTA. Was the preservative just another fantasy? I'd been told that blood evidence numbers 30 and 31, the red smears located on the console of Simpson's Bronco, had not been present when the truck was taken to the fingerprint shed on June 13, 1994. A detective employed by the LAPD, Kelly Muldorfer, had taken the witness stand and given testimony that substantiated this claim. She hadn't seen any of these blood smears several days after the crimes had occurred. I'd been told that Furman and at least one other officer had driven over to Simpson's residence in the early morning hours of June 13th, well before Furman made the trip to 360 North Rockingham with Detectives Lang, Van Atter, and Phillips. This issue had also been raised in the courtroom when Rosa Lopez talked about hearing men's voices arguing on Simpson's property in the middle of the night. They knew they'd left the scene of a crime to go in search of something, which was an unprecedented thing for police officers to do. The argument, it was explained to me, erupted when that, quote, something, unquote, could not be found. By the way, I should indicate for formal legal purposes that no one has been charged, let alone convicted, of any crimes in connection with the framing of O.J. Simpson, although Mark Furman obviously did perjure himself in connection with the case when he said he had never used the word, quote, nigger, unquote, in the last 10 years. Continuing, I'd been told that the blood swatch numbers 47 through 52 in evidence were not what they appeared to be. The prosecution said these blood drops had been picked up at Nicole's condo on the morning of June 13th, and later tests revealed that the drops contained O.J. Simpson's DNA. But on August 26, 1995, Dr. Henry Lee, widely regarded as the most renowned forensic scientist in America, if not the world, came into the courtroom and was asked by Barry Scheck about one of these drops. Lee said that after carefully examining four small blood marks on the paper packet that had been wrapped around the blood evidence taken from the condo, he'd concluded that the crime scene swatches could have leaked onto the paper only if they'd been packaged when still wet. LAPD technicians, however, had already testified that the swatches had dried overnight before packaging. What did this mean? Scheck asked. The only explanation I can give under these circumstances, Dr. Lee replied, is something's wrong, unquote. Scheck did not press Dr. Lee to go further, but the clear inference was that someone could have gone into the crime lab on the night of June 13th and tampered with the drying swatches or put Simpson's blood on them. I'd been told one thing that had struck me as being so far-fetched as to be absurd. In August of 1994, my source had said that if certain information were to come out in the wrong way, Los Angeles might see worse race riots than those that had followed the first Rodney King verdict in the spring of 1992. A year later, angry groups of African-American citizens were gathering outside of the courthouse carrying signs and protesting the racism of Mark Furman and the LAPD. The mayor, the city's police chief, and the governor of California were all making public appearances asking people not to resort to violence in the streets once again. The fear of more riots was now anything but absurd. I'd been told that I was being given information about the Simpson case because of a book I'd written, another assertion that at first had made no sense. Now, it was known during the past decade, Mark Furman had expressed views closely aligned to the sympathies of the neo-Nazis who'd murdered Alan Berg. Now, what I'd been told had made perfect sense. Indeed, in our last segment, the next segment, we're going to ruminate about the implications of the O.J. Simpson case as a political and sociological event. Please note that over the years I've put together a series of archive shows that are available from a tape duplication service. The archive shows are a form of radio documentary in which the printed sources upon which my lines of argument are based are read on the air, literally excerpted on the air so that listeners can tape the programs and then use the resulting tapes as an audio study resource. All of these archive shows, again, are on permanent file with a tape duplication service. More about that right now.
All of Dave Emery's archive shows are available from a tape duplication service named Archives on Audio. They can be contacted at P.O. Box 170023, San Francisco, zip code 94117-0023. The phone number is 415-346-1840. Again, Archives on Audio can be reached at P.O. Box 170023, San Francisco, 94117-0023. The phone number, 415-346-1840. There is also a catalog available which lists all of the archive shows, gives a synoptic description of each show, and cross-references the programs with other broadcasts containing similar or related material. The Archives on Audio catalog is available on the KFJC webpage, which is reached at http://www.cygnus.com/KFJC/Emory. Again, the website, all lowercase letters, is http://www.cygnus.com/KFJC/Emory. The website also has a suggested reading list and a list of other sources to pursue for more information on this field of research. Neither Dave Emery nor KFJC gets money from this arrangement.
KFJC, by the way, is the station in the South San Francisco Bay Area at which I record these programs. By the way, these half-hour segments are not available from Archives on Audio, but are to be made available through another source. I will have more information about that very shortly. If you would like to contact me about this, you can write to me. My name is Dave Emery, last name E-M-O-R-Y, care of KFJC-FM, care of KFJC-FM. And the address is 12345, that's 12345, El Monte Road, capital E-L, capital M-O-N-T-E Road. That's in Los Altos Hills, L-O-S, capital A-L-T-O-S, Hills, in California. The zip code is 94022. Once again, that address, Dave Emery, care of KFJC-FM, 12345, El Monte Road, Los Altos Hills, California, 94022. That concludes this half-hour segment. In our next segment, we're going to wrap up this series about O.J. Simpson and ruminate about some of the political and sociological implications of the case. Following the actual excerpting of the text, there is a three-part interview with the author, Stephen Singular, recorded on April 21st of 1996 that will not only sum up the book, but talk about some of the implications of this particular case. That concludes this segment. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.